Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sociology. I'm Patrick Sheehan, one of your hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Gil Eyal, professor of sociology at Columbia University, about his new book, The Crisis of Expertise, out in 2019 from Polity Press. In the book, Dr. Eyal analyzes the apparent rise of mistrust of experts of all types these days on big consequential topics, from Brexit to climate change to vaccinations. But the book goes well beyond the current crisis, digging into the history and negotiated meanings of expertise over time. He shows that the current mistrust is not so much new as it is the latest expression of an ongoing, recursive tension of legitimacy that emerges when regulatory science and politics intersect. Dr. Eyal, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I want to begin with where you start in the book, by laying out sort of a first pass at our current crisis of expertise. You begin with a moment in 2016 in which Michael Gove, a conservative British politician, pro-Brexit campaigner, was being interviewed on a news show in the lead up to the Brexit vote. Would you tell us about that moment and then sort of expand that outwards to describe the public perception of the larger crisis of expertise you're taking on in the book?
Okay. So as part of the debates about Brexit, there was, of course, a lot of argument from the anti-Brexit side that, you know, this will be devastating to Britain economically. And as the debate unfolded, the Sky TV network invited British politicians one by one to be interviewed about this. Just before Michael Gove, they interviewed David Cameron, the prime minister at the time, who was against Brexit. And then when Gove was brought in, the interviewer, of course, sort of put it to him that, you know, all the experts from the Bank of England, from the European Central Bank, you know, from the World Bank, from, you know, a list of acronyms, are saying, you know, that the consequences to British economy are going to be devastating. And, you know, he pushed him on that until at a certain point, Gove replied by saying something along the lines of the British people have had enough of experts who keep telling them what to do, keep getting it wrong, and are not elected, et cetera, et cetera. This caused an uproar. It was a headline in newspapers the following day. I must say, you know, when I first saw it, of course, I was also, you know, enraged, you know, what do you mean had enough of experts, etc. You know, when I came to think about it, of course, I saw he had a point, obviously. This was happening, you know, less than 10 years after the financial crisis. The experts who were telling Britain whatever they were telling did get it wrong before. None of them predicted the crisis. None of them knew what to do about it. Many of them, in some sense, could have been entangled and involved in the dynamics that led to the crisis with the derivatives, etc. So there was, you know, it's not that Gove was right or not, but there was, you know, so he had a point. Sort of a characteristic moment that we are now seeing over and over again, just with the Trump administration, with the EPA, and climate change, or with the arguments about vaccinations, you know, the other side comes and says, we don't believe the experts. Why should we believe the experts, et cetera, et cetera. So this is kind of the setup, because the response, my response, as I said, originally, I was enraged like a lot of other people, and the response from among the experts and let's call it the educated classes would be to dismiss this and to say, you know, these people don't understand, et cetera, et cetera. But then in the second response, they would sort of throw their hands up in the air and they would say, yes, expertise is dead. People don't believe the experts anymore. In the book, I refer to a book that was published indeed in 2016 titled The Death of Expertise. And that's the argument there, you know, namely that the internet has empowered people to think that they just do their own research and they don't need to think to listen to the experts, etc. And so now we have to ask ourselves, okay, does that make sense, right? Do events like this, and indeed the quite significant attack on regulatory science, does that mean that expertise and experts are not important? So in the book, I sort of try to balance it and say what is interesting about the moment right now is the fact that on the one hand, yes, there is clearly mistrust of experts, mistrust of science, at least in some circles. But on the other hand, our society is one that is more dependent on experts and science than any society before it. It is science and expertise is sort of wired into the way politics are done, the way regulation is done, the way we go about our daily lives even. So what is interesting in this current moment is on the one hand, the immense reliance on expertise. We can't do without it. And yet the mistrust of it. That is what I call the crisis. Does that answer the question?
Perfectly. And I want to, for the rest of the book, you do a wonderful job of historicizing the way experts have played into politics throughout history. And I wonder if you could just really nail down to us, you argue that expertise has always been this sort of contested lane between science and politics. Could you talk to us about what's the nature of the friction between those institutions? Why isn't it a simple question of experts present information, public considers it and decides? And also, you mentioned that what's contested here is not all of science, let's say. You know, no one's up in arms about the latest findings in quantum physics. Help us understand, you know, the nature of the tension and what exactly is coming together. You talk about regulatory science and democratic politics.
Yeah, that's what the book is focused on. And I should just say parenthetically that in discussions after the book, people said to me, well, you know, that's a bit narrow because you could see that there is mistrust or sort of a downgrading of experts across the board, not only in regulatory science. And I think that's true. So I can come back to that in a second. But at the moment, let me just say that, you know, often when people think about this, they sort of feel that science and reason are under attack. And this is the most common in this term that is used today when we're talking about that we live in a post-truth era. I don't buy that. I don't know what would be a post-truth era, because if we are in a post-truth era, it means that in the past we lived in truth. And I just don't think that's true. And so the book really tries to ask, okay, where exactly is the crisis? And I do focus on regulatory science, which is a very new term, by the way. It's not something that is a term that was introduced in the 1980s. It's not something that was used before. It was a term that they introduced in the 1980s to identify a phenomenon that was really growing in significance from the 50s onwards. The reason why I think, you know, there is this fraught relationship between science and politics, and that this fraught relationship is where the crisis is as follows. Increasingly, in modern society, the state, legal institutions, and politicians need input from science and experts. This is because we live in what you might call a state-regulated capitalism, namely an economic and political system that systematically produces redistributive consequences that impact people in an unequal way. And you can think about it in terms of income, you know, who, you know, tax policy or whatever, you know, who gets what. But also you can think about it in terms of pollution as well. Our system produces, pollutes the globe in a way that impacts everybody, but also impacts us unequally. Some neighborhoods are more polluted than others. Turns out that typically, you know, neighborhoods where poor people live, et cetera. And so you can extend this point about the redistributive effects of state-regulated capitalism, you know, from, you know, just fiscal matters to pollution to health consequences in terms of who is treated, who is not, for what illnesses receive attention, et cetera. Now, as long as this was decided by the market, one could always basically defend those unequal consequences as a result of fair competition. But since, you know, we exist in a system in which the state plays a crucial role in setting the rules of the game, regulating it, incentivizing some actors and some results and not incentivizing others, etc. The unequal results, you know, could be traced back to the decisions of politicians. That means that politicians need to defend those decisions. This is not my own argument. You know, it has been an argument of neo-Marxists, Habermas, O'Connor, many others, ever since the 1960s. One way of doing this is to indeed recruit science and scientists to defend those decisions. And not just defend those decisions. I mean, I'm presenting it as perhaps a bit too cynically. Basically, to inform the process of decision-making in a way that, you know, could make a good faith argument that it has been rational, that it has taken into account empirical evidence, that it has, attempted to balance, different interests and different considerations, etc. And the argument of neo-Marxists, you know, back in the 60s and the 70s was that in this way science helps to plays an ideological role, helps to resolve the legitimation crisis of the state. But in reality, when we look at it in the perspective of 50 years, what happens here is that science gets infected with that legitimation crisis. Namely, politics gets, as I say in the book, politics gets scientized in the sense that science is brought in to inform a great deal of political decisions. But the obverse of that is that science becomes politicized. And, you know, the examples of this multiple from decisions about, you know, where to site nuclear reactors to decisions about clinical trials for medications for HIV to any of those things are now matters that are politicized. And they are politicized in the sense that the science that is involved, I call it regulatory science, is different than, you know, your basic science, your sort of basic science that is interested in figuring out basic facts about, you know, how nature works, because regulatory science is ultimately meant to assist and arrive at a decision. And this is the point at which it becomes, therefore, contested. When I say to assist and arrive at a decision, you can note that the characteristic concepts and devices of regulatory science are all aiming at that. Things like defining what are the acceptable levels of pollution, for example. This is clearly research that is informed by basic knowledge about how nature works, but also is required to do something that a scientist doesn't necessarily need to do, which is take into account, you know, what is going to be the impact of humans, what is going to be the impact on humans in a real environment, not in the laboratory environment, in a real environment that is saturated also with other pollutants over a life course. Take into account also the economic consequences of regulating or not regulating and at what level, and then arrive at a decision. So concepts like cutoffs and acceptable levels are the characteristic concepts of regulatory science, but they are essentially contested. They are intrinsically contested. They always involve, you know, certain heuristics, rule of thumbs, decision about how to balance contradictory interests, etc. And we see this with vaccination. Yes, vaccination is strongly contested because what is involved in it is a decision that the benefits to public health outweigh some small risk that, you know, does exist and really does exist for individuals. It's not that the people who object to vaccination don't know anything about it. Yes, there is a small risk. You know, but the question is, you know, when you balance it against the consequences of public health, what's more important? So this is kind of the terrain that the book is examining, you know, the terrain of regulatory science that is politicized for those reasons that I was talking about.
That's great examples and discussion of it. I guess from here, I want to talk about you've got a number of really great like 2x2 tables, which I think everyone appreciates in the book. Particularly, you talk about two sort of axes of tensions around what expertise ought to do in society. And there's one sort of a problem of extension of expertise, the question being, who should be included as an expert? How much should it be monopolized by a small group of people, technocrats, or how much should it be sort of dispersed and democratized? And a second axis, which is, I think you write, the problems of trust. When do we think expertise should sort of be mechanical and objective, exemplified by can we make our experts just an AI algorithm, versus how much should we be trusting people with particular trained judgment? I wonder if you could talk about each of those. Maybe first the question of extension, how that's played out, and then I'll ask you about the trust question.
Okay, so the term, the problem of extension is not my own. It actually comes from Harry Collins and Robert Evans' book also about expertise, and they're really the ones who kind of started the discussion about this. So what it refers to is as follows. Ever since probably the 80s, it has become clearer and clearer that in those debates about regulatory science, there's a new cast of characters. And the new cast of characters has been described in various ways, sometimes called lay experts. This is a term that Steve Epstein used. Collins and Evans call them experience-based experts. Other people will call them stakeholders, advocates, etc. Point being is that those debates become a site where not just the credential experts have a say, but people who have expertise in you know, in other forms, and often people who have a personal stake in the result become important players. And once you actually consider that in a broader perspective, you realize, yes, this was a response to the legitimation crisis of regulatory science. One of the responses was, since experts are mistrusted, what you can do is you can bring lay people in, stakeholders, advocates, whatever you call it, and involve them in decision-making, and in this way legitimate the decision. This was written into the legislation that created the EPA in the United States, that it should have environmental impact assessments, and that those assessments would go to the communities that are impacted, have town halls, have people participate in decision making, etc. Now, often that can be just a way of protecting yourself from criticism without really taking into account the points of view of lay people. But lay people have demanded a seat at the table, and they increasingly have it. Now, Collins and Evans raise the questions, and they say, where should you draw the line? If we're thinking about vaccination, for example, everybody are impacted, and everybody can claim some form of knowledge or expertise about it. So who should really be participants in debates about issues that are technical, that require expertise, but also impact, ordinary lay people? Do we have some kind of knowledge that will allow us to draw the line somewhere and say, only these people really should participate in this debate? Only this form of expertise is really pertinent. I think Collins and Evans point out quite correctly that existing sociological approaches to professions and expertise give you no way of dealing with this question, because they basically tend to treat expertise as socially constructed. And so they try to offer, a way of distinguishing between who has relevant expertise or not. This is not a route I follow in the book, because I just don't believe people are going to listen to sociologists. They would ask, well, would you have the expertise to tell us who has expertise? And you're going to dive into this rabbit hole and never come out. What I try to do in the book is, first of all, show that our different approaches and theories to expertise can be described indeed as giving different answers to this question, and or different ways of grappling with this problem, and also sort of look at it as one of the as a dimension of responses to the crisis. And it could be all the way from one side, sort of boundary work that says only this group of experts who are credentialed and have been selected very carefully to be neutral can make the decision about this. This is a sort of advisory committee appointed by the National Academy of Sciences or something like that. And then they would also say, let's shroud their debates and discussions, and so people don't know what they're discussing, because otherwise it will become too politicized. Let them be protected, and this way you can achieve neutrality. And then all the way to the other side, which is, this should be a free-for-all. Everybody who's impacted should be able to engage in a debate in a transparent manner. I don't really come down on either side. What I try to show is that those are responses to the crisis that actually sort of exacerbate it. The attempt to limit the debate to just the certified group of experts is meant to communicate neutrality, but is often seen as basically, well, they have something to hide. But opening up the debate to you know, whoever considers themselves lay experts typically prevents arriving at a decision, really extends the time, also creates an opening for what others have called the emergence of doubt. Yeah, corporations and other interested actors who then participate in the debate with sort of an interest of keeping it always open, saying, you know, oh, well, there's another side, you know, and you have to have a balanced argument, et cetera, et cetera. So there's some doubt regarding climate change, et cetera. This is the sort of dangers that, you know, fully open conversation on these issues creates. So it's not that I have a solution to this. The book is called The Crisis of Expertise, and it does not actually have a solution for it.
That's great. And yeah, I must say that some of my democratic instincts, you know, my first pass at, I want to include, you know, obviously include as many people as we can in these kind of decisions that are going to affect everyone. But you make the point that inclusion doesn't necessarily lead to legitimacy. And I particularly appreciate the point about there may be no decision we'll become to. If everyone's included, there's no final stopping point the way an FDA down a final decision. That's I hadn't thought about before. Now let's move to the second axis, which is trust. Would you sort of describe to us the two poles of that and give us as many examples as you can along the way to help us understand each part.
Okay. This is really now a question not about who should be included in the debate, but how to create trust in the decisions and the regulatory mandates that come out of those debates. If you look So the two poles here are the following. One is, we trust in experts. Namely, you go to your doctor, for example, because you believe that the doctor has experience. And in fact, you try to pick a doctor that, so in the book I say, if you discover that you have cancer, you're going to try to pick doctors who have a lot of experience, who have seen a lot of patients like you, who, as we know from people who have studied experts and expertise, they have now cultivated this kind of judgment about what details in the case are the important details that one should attend to. So there's been a lot of research on experts and expertise and what I found very convincing is the point that one is an expert not by virtue of knowing the general rules, but actually knowing the details. Yes, that knowing to take in a picture, in this case, let's say the picture of a patient, and being able to compare it to many, many, many similar patients you've seen in the past, and then knowing to zero in on what details here are the most relevant. And so, the idea is we can trust the experienced experts. And if you do the etymology of the word expertise, it does come from the word for experience and tried, somebody who has been tried, somebody who has accumulated knowledge and know-how by means of experience. And a lot of institutions in our society do indeed attempt to create trust by means of selecting the experienced experts, guaranteeing, that these are the best expert and then relying on their judgment. Parties in court, for example, will bring experts to testify, on their behalf. Then, however, we have been exposed over the last 50 to 60 years to many, many, many cases where the best expert judgment has been proven wrong. and in fact has been proven biased, and the standards that are recognized among the experts for what is good judgment turn out to be parochial and problematic. The best example is probably what Simon Cole wrote about the fingerprint identification. Yeah, those experts in the police, the FBI, etc., who have a set of rules and a lot of experience in deciding what fingerprints match. And then they'll spectacular problems with what turns out to be the argumentation as to what matches or not. And then you realize that, a lot of the decisions are based on sort of heuristics and rules of thumb and conventions that are agreed upon among the experts. And while for them it's taken for granted, somebody looking at it from the outside would start to question that judgment. And similarly, Michael Gove, when he says, British people are tired of the experts, it's basically saying, yes, we relied on the expert judgment of the economists, and look where it got us. The other poll is basically an attempt to get away from expert judgment and to say, let's define a standardized procedure that mechanically, without needing to resort to judgment, will arrive at the correct decision. This is has been suggested by this famous book by Ted Porter from UCLA, Trust in Numbers, where the suggestion is that the reliance on quantitative measurement, standardized procedures, and we are getting it to it today, algorithms and artificial intelligence is a solution to the legitimation problem or the trust problem of the experts. Instead of relying on the judgments of fallible actors, we will define a procedure that will arrive at the same decision if the same data is there, in a more trustworthy, foolproof way. Porter notes, and I think quite correctly, that this tends to be the situation when experts are weak and somewhat mistrusted and do not command a lot of credibility in society, is that then there is a tendency to replace expert with trust in numbers. And so I point out in the book, that there are there are many areas in regulatory science that we rely on this. For example, the use of randomized controlled trials in clinical trials to decide when medications are efficacious and safe enough, to be sold to the public, et cetera, et cetera. We do not. We used to rely on expert judgment in this. The way to decide this used to be to distribute those to doctors and have the doctors report back on, whether they were useful and safe or not. We don't do that anymore ever since, the 1960s. Instead, we have, sort of a foolproof, double-blind, randomized controlled trial that attempts to eliminate any element of judgment because judgment is taken to be bias in order to arrive at, a clear decision as to what is efficacious and safe and what is not. In the book, I point out, and I'm not the first one to do this, that there are a lot of problems with this, that, randomized controlled trials, for example, one cannot quite trust them, that they don't arrive always at the correct decisions, that they leave an enormous amount actually outside their purview, that they cannot, for example, protect populations from relatively rare but very serious consequences of medications, etc. So the way to see this pool is to see that there is a set of reactions to the crisis of mistrust in experts, but each of those reactions, again, sort of undermine one another. So when you rely on what is called mechanical objectivity, trust in numbers, randomized controlled trials, you communicate the sense that experts are biased and you cannot rely on them. So that undermines, you know, other kinds of arrangements in which we were trusting of experts before. So this is part of this crisis that I'm describing, in which the very reactions to the crisis actually exacerbate it.
That's wonderful. And I encourage readers to get the book, because the clarity of the sort of different four different boxes we need. You talk, Dr. Ayal, about four different responses to the legitimation crisis kind of along these axes, and it provides a lot of clarity as someone who's observing these happen all around. I want to ask, particularly, you have a chapter in there just on trust, sort of the concept of trust. And towards the end of the chapter, you come to describing trust in experts as a almost sort of sacred relationship that can be really polluted, that I found very interesting. Would you talk to us a little bit about that? And you give a sort of vignette of someone going into the doctor's office. Maybe you could start there, or just could you talk a bit more about what is the basis of trust?
So yeah, this is a hard one, and I must say, you know, this chapter was the newest part of the book, and you know, I'm not completely done with this question. In fact, next year I'm starting a sort of a 2-year Mellon Soil seminar on trust and mistrust in experts at Columbia University. And so we will continue thinking about this question. But a couple of things. The first point is that, you know, we are very concerned about mistrust of experts. And we say, you know, whenever you hear, you know, people resist vaccinations or do not believe in climate change, you say, how can they not trust? How come they are so misinformed as to not understand it? But the point I'm making in this chapter is that the real mystery, the real question is not mistrust, but it is trust. And this is not my own point. It's also the theorists who have written about trust and made this point, Anthony Giddens, Niklas Luhmann, and others. Mistrust, and it's also you know, the common saying is that it is very hard to build trust and very easy to destroy it. It's true, yes, and that's why mistrust is not actually so much of a puzzle. Many, many, many things can create mistrust. What is a puzzle is, why do we trust the experts? I mean, at the end of the day, we are asked to trust knowledge that we don't quite understand, that we haven't seen how it was created, that we will not be able quite to trace the chain of reasoning, the chain of analysis, the chain of data that has led to the final decision. And that, you know, this knowledge at the end of the day led to sort of weighed certain options and arrived at the argument that this option is the best, but many other possibilities are there. So why do we trust experts? I mean, in the book I give a lot of examples, but vaccination obviously is the best one. I quote, and it's from an article by two British sociologists who interviewed parents who began to resist vaccination. And one of them says, I know that it is a very small chance. It's a minuscule chance. So this person is not actually ill-informed. They are well-informed. But then he says, he or she, I forget if it was the mother or the father, but they say, what if it does happen? And how could you forgive yourself? And that you living the rest of your life knowing that you did this to your child. Now, what comes out here is the fact that while, you know, all the knowledge that we have indeed does indicate that the risk is small, that's not how the balance is going to be for ordinary people. Because even small risk can become something of huge consequence, and then a source of mistrust. So a person who comes in, originally trusting a vaccination, when the question comes up, should I or should I not do it because there is this small risk? The moment this question comes up, mistrust appears, and it becomes quite easy to decide not to do it. So there's a sort of a lack of balance here. And that indicates, to me at least, is that, the reason why we trust, let's say, vaccination or other forms of the ways in which expertise is embedded in our lives is because it is embedded in routines. It is embedded in routines that are not and recognized scripts and familiar scripts, etc. And those do not foreground the question of trust and the question of risk. The moment it is foregrounded, the game is over. Yeah. But as long as it is not foregrounded, it can create trust. So trust exists to the extent that it is embedded in routines, familiar stories, familiar scripts, etc. So, where I live in New York City, you have those, you used to have them, actually, you don't have them anymore, those yellow cards on which all your child's vaccinations are noted, plus the height and weight, and all the other milestones of development. And so you come into the doctor's office with this, and you compare it with other parents, and it just becomes part of a routine script. And the question of trust is not raised. What I was trying to show in this chapter is that the routines and the scenes that create trust are frames in the Goffmanian sense, frames that do not foreground the future, yes, the what if of the longer term, and also do not foreground the moment of decision, the quote unquote leap of faith. Should I do it? Should I not? They foreground the middle term, if you will, the middle range, the middle temporal range of the familiar routines of going to the doctor, et cetera, et cetera. And those familiar routines, frames of the middle temporal range, become part of the doxa, become part of the what is taken for granted in everyday life. I forget the final part of your answer of your question.
No, that was it. I was trying to think of the nature the trust relationship between expert and laity. And I think that's great steps. I want to, you spend so much of the book.
Oh, I forget. I now remember. There's one other point is that trust is almost a sort of an extension of yourself. Yes. You, by trusting not just other people, but those routines in which your lives are embedded, you sort of extend the boundaries of the self to include them. And that means, and this is how the chapter ends, that means that when there is a sense of that trust betrayed, it's experienced as pollution, in the sense that Mary Douglas talks about it, in the sense that something foreign has entered into what was familiar, what was me, has crossed boundaries between the inside and the outside, etc. And this is why this sense of pollution accompanies the moment of failure of trust, the appearance of mistrust. And pollution, as we know from Mary Douglas, is a form of social criticism directed at the experts and those that are on top. And so Yeah, that's how the chapter ends, in order to point out that those episodes of mistrust then become sources of powerful criticism of experts and regulatory science.
And then towards the end of the book, you know, you spend so much time analyzing the critiques of expertise that we're seeing today and that we've seen over time. Towards the end of the book, you give a chapter in which you start with a biblical story as a way of about the impacts that these critiques actually will have on the long-term place of experts. Would you tell us about Balaam's blessing, and then sort of how it can help us to think more clearly about this moment?
Yeah. So in this, just before the people of Israel, after they journeyed in the desert for 40 years, arrived to the land of Canaan, they are sort of camping in the Transjordan area, and the people around them are quite scared. And one of the kings decides, okay, I'm going to go to my prophet, my magician, and have him curse these people. So he goes to Balaam and asks him to curse the people of Israel. Balaam is very reluctant, and on the way to doing that, he meets with an angel of God, and the angel of God stops his way, says he shouldn't do it, and he says, but I was told to do it. And he says, okay, you can go ahead, but you will say only what I will have you say. And when Balaam comes there, opens his mouth to curse the people of Israel, he instead blesses them. He says, you know, oh, you sons of Jacob, you know, may your seed will become as plentiful as the the grains of sand on the seaside, et cetera, et cetera, and for years to come. This becomes sort of an idiom in Hebrew about, somebody who sets out to curse and ends up blessing, namely the way in which sometimes an attack can become the opposite, or attack or a criticism can achieve the opposite of what it does. And I use this in order to inject a little bit of optimism into the story of the crisis of expertise, pointing out multiple times, multiple ways in which the critique of experts and the critiques of the institutions of regulatory science ends up shoring them up. Especially, I use wonderful examples given by Carpenter in his great book about the FDA, in which, you know, every time somebody comes up and say, you know, the FDA got it wrong, you know, or there is corruption, or you know, how could they get this decision wrong, et cetera, they end up saying, what we need to do is to give more money to the FDA. Or what we need to do is to strengthen the decision-making process at the FDA. Et cetera, et cetera. So the critique ends up shoring up the significance, the position, and the need for the experts, the institutions of expertise, et cetera. And that really sort of returns to the point I kind of started with. Yeah. Yes, we are in the middle of a multi-pronged attack on experts and regulatory science from some politicians. Yes, there is mistrust of experts from activists and others. But the other side of it is the fact that we are very much reliant on them. And in the United States, at least, it's very hard to arrive at binding political decisions about certain topics without relying on experts. So, the Trump administration, for example, is trying to get rid of a wholesale of, you know, ways of regulating pollution. But they're challenging court. And when they're challenging court, what they need to do, according to American law, is to show that the decision was not capricious. And how do you show that the decision was not capricious? You show that it was taken in a rational manner. taking into account empirical evidence, consulting the relevant experts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the day, you know, even attempts to attack experts and get rid of them have to rely on the institutions of expertise. So that is sort of what I'm trying to show in this chapter is that as bad as things are, and they are bad, it's not that the other side is was trying to minimize the reliance on experts can really achieve that. At the end of the day, they're always sort of cast back towards a reliance on experts. The other example I give there is it's called surfacestation.org. This was an attempt by climate skeptics, climate change skeptics, and conservative activists to sort of audit climate science. And what they did was they say, well, how do we know that really the temperatures are changing? Maybe they have a measurement and maybe they're measuring it wrong. And they basically said, okay, we'll go and do our own measurements at all where all the climate stations are, where all the surface stations are. And, you know, they engage in a quite impressive campaign of citizen science. And for a while, you know, they had articles in which they said, no, we arrived at somewhat different results, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, what happened is that they ended up discovering that the measurements were more or less correct, that other factors also have to take into account. They basically were drawn into, you know, the debates, the arguments, and the evidence mobilized by climate science. And once they got in, they had to play by those rules of the game. And, you know, if you look up surfacestation.org on the internet today, it's closed. Yeah, they failed in that fight. So, you know, obviously that's just one example, and there are many others on the other side as well. But I just did not want to paint a completely bleak picture there. Yeah, we are reliant on experts and expertise and the institutions of regulatory science. They're not going to go away just because you know, some administration is trying to change this or that regulation.
And it did have that effect on a reader to inject some hope. After all, another question: you are, like you said, short on prescriptions about what to do on the crisis, but you do offer a few things. One is a nice little metaphor about trying to, quote, ride the vortex of this crisis. And a second is the offer in the conclusion. You offer term trans science for helping us to think about this and as sort of a piece of advice for people who themselves are considered experts about how to present themselves and expert knowledge. Would you talk to us both about riding the vortex and then about trans science?
Okay. I'm not completely sure about riding the vortex, I must say. I use this metaphor, this thing that I was told when I was a child, going to the beach, and I was told that there's those maelstroms, those vortex, those riptides, you know, that you have to be careful about. And the thing about them is that if they swept you, you shouldn't fight them. You can't. And if you fight them, you'll just get too tired and you'll drown. Your best bet is to, first of all, try to signal to other people to come help you. And then you have to try to ride them because they might spit you out. I cannot, don't take this as a, you know, as a prescription, because I don't know if this really works. I never, luckily I was never in that situation. But the metaphor here is something that I start the book with. I say, you know, if we want to get through this, we first of all have to clear our language of certain terms. We should stop talking about how this is a post-truth area and the facts are on our side, or that this is an attack on science and how those people can deny science. And I don't like the term climate deniers or anti-vaxxers or something like that. These are terms of polarization. And the thing is trying to fight the vortex, trying to fight the crisis of expertise leads to increased polarization, which I think just exacerbates the crisis. Instead, I think one should be able to recognize the point at which the other side is rational, and is not completely misguided and motivated by some ulterior motives, and should attempt to create a conversation. So vaccination, I think, is a good example. Most of the people who decide at one point or another not to vaccinate their child are not anti-vaxxers. They're not ideologically absolutely opposed to vaccination. Often they say, "I'll pick and choose what I want to vaccinate my child and what I don't." And so when you attack them in vehement terms, as deniers of the importance of vaccine or something like that, you ultimately turn them into anti-vaxxers. So you exacerbate the problem. So riding the vortex is, continuing this hand-to-hand fight in the corridors of science, regulatory science, with as little name calling as possible, and without sort of always attempting to resort to the argument that the facts are on our sides, because these are not facts; these are estimates that, and that means that their credibility is something that is in question and has to be shown over and over again. That's so much for riding the vortex. Transcience is not my own term; it's a term introduced by Alvin Weinberg, who was, a famous physicist and the director of the Oak Ridge National Laboratories. What he said was that, and that was back in the 1970s, he says a lot of those debates are not really about science. They're about what he called transcience, namely questions that science actually cannot quite answer. Now, I don't want to get right now into the whole discussion of why is it that science cannot answer them, what kind of questions they have. But this is the important point. It's I started with it as well. These are not questions about facts that, science can give a very clear answer about. These are questions about estimates, assessments, things for which you have to create credibility, things for which you have to orchestrate credibility. And we have to recognize that. Now, we talked about credibility in a sense before, because we talked about trust. Yes, what creates trust? Is it, the trust in expert judgment or the mechanical objectivity or something like that? Neither of this quite work. We need to we need to come up with new ways of bolstering the credibility of those kind of assessments and estimates and knowledge that is created by regulatory science. So that's kind of like where the book ends. The book says, this we have to recognize this is not about science. It's about this realm in between science and politics, a realm in which, yes, data matters, but credibility matters as well. And we need to come up with new institutions that allow the data to speak, but also orchestrate credibility. This is our crisis. We don't have the right institutions right now. They are at the moment, are under attack. I don't have an answer, but just to give because I don't think a book can give an answer to that. This is something that has to be worked out. As John Dewey would have said, experimentally, through public conversation and public attempts to create those institutions. But just to give an example of what that could be, I mean, on one side of the debate is the suggestion, and I now forget the name of the Supreme Justice. I forgot his name.
Is it Stephen Breyer?
Stephen Breyer, yeah. So I found myself, you know, surprisingly attracted to his suggestion, even though this is not where I started at all. And his suggestion is, you know, we need, he said, a new administrative agency. Yeah, it seems weird that, you know, in this day and age where there's so much mistrust of the state, this would be the solution. And I'm not sure this is the solution. But what he says is, you know, and this really resonated with me as you know, as we were going through the investigation of President Trump, and civil servant after civil servant came and testified in front of Congress, and you suddenly saw once again something that we forgot, you know, that civil servants are committed, you know, to the good of the public, that they are, you know, that they are often bind themselves by very strong ethical standards, that they have, you know, experience and expertise that is, you know, that is pertinent, you know, that they defend a particular way of running the affairs of state that is informed by expertise and by rational procedure. And so Breyer suggests, okay, since our politics of risk and expertise are under attack, let's attempt to recreate the prestige of an administrative agency and create an administrative agency that is absolutely dedicated to the question of how do you regulate risk. I mean, it is done in the APA and in other places right now, but this would be, you know, a dedicated civil service career, you know, and a place where, you know, the best and the brightest will be recruited, et cetera, et cetera. One way in which creating a sort of a trans-scientific institution, this one sort of biased a little bit more towards the political side, the legal side, the creation of credibility. On the other side, you could talk about the IPCC as an example of a trans-scientific institution. But as to, you know, how to protect and bolster the credibility of these institutions, I don't think I can give a prescription.
Well, Dr. Ayal, we've taken up a lot of your time. The last question we'd like to ask on Newberg's Network is about your forward-looking research. You've mentioned a couple things that you're interested out of here. Are there particular questions that you plan to pursue after this book? Some things that have come up that are particularly interesting to you?
Yeah, so I want to say a word about this Mellon Sawyer seminar, because yes, my work will be dedicated still less in the next couple of years to this question of mistrust of experts. And the seminar is meant, on the one hand, to be a sort of an investigation into the nature of trust and the institutions and the routines and the mechanisms that create trust, bringing in scholars that are not just from the social sciences but also from the humanities and also natural scientists. And on the other hand, we'll also explore, in a series of public events, some of the sources of the mistrust of experts and how can they be not overcome so much, but negotiated with, discussed, opened up, etc., by holding public forums that bring in people, you know, from various parts of society to discuss this. So we will have a semester dedicated to climate science and the metal of climate change, and we'll have climate scientists speaking to members of the public, and we will have that semester followed up by, you know, going into some of the neighborhoods in New York that are already impacted in one way or another by climate change, because, for example, they're impacted by Sandy, or, you know, or they are asking, you know, I mean, are they going to be protected from flooding or not? And you know, have conversations there between experts and members of those communities. And then we'll have two more semesters the following year, one indeed dedicated mostly to vaccination, and another to the question of trust in algorithms and artificial intelligence you know, those are very pertinent questions right now. So this is what I'm going to do right now. I'm not going to so much dedicate, sit down to write a new book about this, but sort of engage in those kind of conversations. And hopefully something will come out of this also in terms of how to think about trust and mistrust.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time and for coming on the show.
Sure.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to speak to you.